Welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio. I'm your host, Dave Custy, for the program that features Baltimoreans of renown who have been successful beyond the shores of the Chesapeake Bay. My guest today is Kenneth Waisman. Ken Waisman, a Tony Award-winning producer, is one of only two producers in the history of Broadway to have a musical run over 3,000 performances and a play run over 1,000. The other producer with this distinction is the infamous David Marek. Waisman developed and produced the original Broadway production of Grease, as well as two of Broadway's longest-running plays, Agnes of God by John Pielmeyer, and Torch Song Trilogy by Harvey Fierstein. He is currently developing Josephine, an original musical inspired by the legendary star of the Folies Bergère in Paris, Josephine Baker. Deborah Cox will play the title role, and Joey McNeely will direct and choreograph. Other Broadway credits include Pulitzer Prize winner Paul Zindel's play and Miss Reardon Drinks a Little with Julie Harris and Estelle Parsons, and the Sherman Brothers musical Over Here, which starred the Andrews sisters and featured Anne Reinking, John Travolta, Mary Lou Henner, and Treat Williams. Waisman made his producing debut with John Herbert's play Fortune and Men's Eyes, which was directed by Sal Mineo and featured Tommy Lee Jones. Welcome, Ken.
Glad to be on the program. How are things in Baltimore?
Baltimore's pretty good.
Are the steam crabs still in season?
I think they are, but we always get them from other places too, like Texas. But I think
I remember being down there during the winter months and not being able to get them. But
yeah.
I love coming down and getting steam crabs, of course.
Well, that's great. Well, we're going to talk all about that. Give me a short bio in your own words of yourself.
Well, I think you covered it all. that was quite nice. I was thinking, oh, is that me? but you covered it all. I can't.
Of course,
impressive. You know, I could tell. I could tell you a little bit more about some of the history behind some of those plays. And
sure, we'll do that. But let's talk about first. Talk about growing up in Baltimore.
Sure. Well, a nice place to grow up. You know, it really was quite special growing up in Baltimore. It was a very unique town. You know, I just remember the independence that we had. Mm-hmm. Now, that probably was universal in those days. But I mean, when I say independence, you know, 11, 12 years old, we're out on our bikes. As long as we come home from dinner, our parents never had an idea where we were.
We were just talking about that because we're of the same age. And I can remember in the summertime, I'd go out after breakfast and they wouldn't see me till dinner.
You know? Exactly. You know, and I mean, they didn't know that we were at the Gwynn movie with pea shooters, shooting the screen, or
yeah,
at the variety store, you know, buying those pea shooters. We would be all over the place, in the woods. I remember playing in the woods near where I lived, going downtown at 10 years old on a streetcar,
right,
you know, by myself, or with Joanne Rogers, Ellison Rogers, who lived across the street. We would go on the 31 streetcar down to Howard Street, you know, see a movie or whatever, go to my dad's store where he worked.
What kind of store did he have?
He was with Leon Levy's Jewelers on Lexington. We'd go to Leon Levy's afterwards, and then he would drive us home. So, I mean, you can't imagine kids having that kind of, you know, independence.
Oh, no. So you grew up in Forest Park, is that right?
I grew up in the Forest Park section until I went to college. Once I was in college, my parents, the family moved to Pikesville. But no, I grew up on Pennhurst Avenue, right, mm-hmm, near, you know, Airedale, near Liberty Heights, near Garrison Boulevard. I mean, it was a great neighborhood in the, you know, back then, and it was a good place to grow up. I knew that I was going to be leaving Baltimore, mm-hmm, because when I was 6 years old, my parents brought me on a trip to New York. I wasn't supposed to come; they were coming on business. But the woman that was going to take care of my sister and me got sick. So they didn't want to leave both of us with my aunt, and they brought me. And so here I was, 6 years old, in New York, and we went to three Broadway shows.
Mm-hmm.
Finian's Rainbow, Oklahoma, and Born Yesterday with Judy Holliday. I was just totally, totally mesmerized.
It was kismet, huh?
Yeah, you know, and I couldn't believe that these were grown-ups on stage and that this was their job.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad being involved in business, in the jewelry business, as I had mentioned, you know, I was like obsessed with the word boss. So I said to my dad, after seeing Finian's Rainbow and being totally blown away, as we're walking up the aisle, I said, who's the boss? And he said, the producer. So that was in August. And in September, went back to school, elementary school number 69, which I think has been torn down since those days.
Mm-hmm.
And the teacher went around the room Now, the reason I know about this is because this incident, I don't remember, but she called my mother. She went around the room and asked each of the kids on the first day of school what they wanted to be when they grew up. And, you know, one kid said a policeman, another kid said a fireman. And when she got to me, I said Broadway producer. And she called my mother and she said, I've been teaching for 20 years. She says, I've heard everything, but I've never heard that. My mother said, well, we just brought him back from a trip to New York. We took him to see a couple of Broadway shows. He'll get over it. But I didn't. By the time I was 11 years old, I had talked my dad into helping me. And I had built a whole theater in my basement. We had seating for 75. We had traverse curtains. We had lights. We had scenery. My dad had built dressing rooms, one for the guys, one for the girls. And every summer for the next 4 years, I would put on shows and use kids in the neighborhood. We would give all the proceeds to charity, and we did musicals, and my father got me the cast albums, and I would splice all of the songs together plus incidental music, you know, on those old reel-to-reel tape recorders.
All right. Yeah.
And then when it came time for a musical number, like when we did Calamity Jane, you know, I'd push a button, and then Doris Day's voice would spew out, and 12-year-old Joanne Ellison was singing, you know, Here We Are in the Windy City. I had my mother call around the different charities to find out which one would put us on television to present the proceeds check. And it turned out that the Maryland Cancer Fund said they would put us on television. So they got the money every year. And we would raise $300-$500 a summer.
Wow, that's great. Jeez.
I charged 50 cents for children and a dollar for adults. We did 8 performances. We did 4 in the afternoon, and then we did 4 evening performances. I would not let kids come to the evening performances unless they were accompanied by an adult, because I wanted the grown-ups.
Sure. Well, you were well-groomed. I mean, you're in the right place.
So that was the beginning of my producing career. You know, and I just stuck with it. So I never had to make that decision of what I wanted to do or be when I grew up. It kind of was made for me by the trip to New York. And I equated New York, when you grow up, if you're an adult, you move to New York.
Right.
Somehow that, you know. So yes. To go back to the earlier comment, you know, I always knew that when I grew up, I'd be leaving Baltimore. But it was a very unique place to grow up in.
Still is.
I'm
based here in Fells Point, and some of the programs I do, like one of them is a show with a woman who lives here and is raising kids in the city, and it's called Urban Mom, and she talks about raising kids in the city and going to charter schools, which are very good schools now, by the way. So things seem to be improving. I was away for 10 years. I was living abroad in Belfast, Northern Ireland, up to last year.
And, really? Until last year?
Yeah, up until last year. So I came back. So I've got a whole different perspective of things of Baltimore. So it really is improving. And so
that's great.
Really,
the city looks
that.
Looks good. I mean, all the redevelopment and everything is quite impressive.
All right. Well, so continue on. Say high school and college.
I went to the University of Maryland first, and then I transferred to, then I went to NYU, School of the Arts. But at Maryland, I put together a whole review called Footlight Fever, and I was part of a group called the Flying Follies. It was like a theater group on campus, and put together this show called Footlight Fever, and petitioned the Army Professional Entertainment Bureau in Washington to send us on a USO tour. And in the summer of 1961, they did just that. We went and toured all over the Caribbean. We played in Guantanamo, Cuba.
Wow, this is from University of Maryland.
From the University of Maryland, yes. Wow. It was quite exciting. We had done a show on campus earlier in the year, like in January, and I had had a lot of people in the cast. But the Army Professional Entertainment Bureau had asked me how many people I would actually need to put the show on. So I said about a dozen people, 12 people. We had originally had about 22. All of a sudden, I'm getting flack, you know, from various professors and other people in the theater department and whatnot about the fact that they have to be in on, we should do a lottery and choose which students get to go. And I said, no, I'm taking the ones that will make the show work. I'm taking the ones that will make the numbers work that I want to do. And I was getting such an argument about this. That I got called in to Dean Elkins' office. Elkins was president of the university at the time. And I you know, and he's telling me that the deans are complaining that this is no way to represent the University of Maryland. It's got to be a democracy. And I was a big fan of Ayn Rand then. You can understand why.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of bureaucratic nonsense. So I simply said to Hillard Elkins, the president, I said, Mr. Elkins, I said, I was the one that petitioned the Army Professional Entertainment Bureau to send us on this tour. The correspondence about the cast, about everything, has been to me personally. So I will assure you that the University of Maryland's name will not be mentioned. Mm-hmm. It will just be a private review that I put together, and we're using University of Maryland students. You can't stop that. But we will not be affiliated with the University of Maryland. We will never mention the University of Maryland's name as any part of this at all. And I'm sure that will clear up this misunderstanding. And I got up and I started to walk out, and he said, hold it. He said, we'll be proud to have our name connected. So that was the end of that.
So you were in producer mode all the way back then, from
even back then,
6 years old to college.
Well, even when I was, even at 12 years old, when we're putting on these shows in my basement, you know, I had to be the tough producer sometimes. One day, one of the girls on the block who had one of the parts when we were doing Showboat didn't show up. And so I called her and I said, why aren't you at rehearsal? And she said, oh, not today. I'm going shopping with my mother today. So I said, well, not any day. You're fired. And she was fired. I replaced her. And, you know, I wouldn't let her mother went nuts. It was very funny because every summer on Pennhurst Avenue, we kids became the adults and the parents became the children. They became the stage mothers, you know, and fathers. We had in Calamity Jane, one of the girls who had been in a couple of the shows, I gave a part. It had one scene and one song. And that was, you know, the size of the part. So the mother said she couldn't be in it. She had been in a couple other plays, and this was much too small a part. So she wasn't allowing herself to be in it. And I happened to mention this to the mother of the girl who was playing Calamity Jane, Joanne Ellison's mother. And she said, that's ridiculous. All the kids in the neighborhood are in the show, and she's going to be left out. So she calls her mother, you know, and she said, why are you doing this? You know, so it's one scene, one song. So then all of a sudden I hear them, you know, she's listening. And then she turns to me and she says, will you promise not to cut the song? I said, sure. But, you know, that's what agents do. So this was sort of like, you know, my representative and an agent negotiating, you know, for a 10-year-old kid to be in one seat in my neighborhood play.
That's great. You promised not to cut the song.
Yeah. So the mother of the girl that I fired from Showbook, she called me a Hitler, and she screamed at me.
Gosh.
She said, you know, it's illegal to charge money when you're under 18. It's illegal. When I was a kid, we only charged safety pins. So I yelled back across the street and I said, I don't think the Cancer Fund wants safety pins.
That's right. You're basically a nonprofit anyway.
Right. Exactly. So it was interesting. The you know, remembering the behaviors is as fascinating as remembering the actual, you know, events.
I remember things like that way back when. I was just talking to someone yesterday. We're talking about growing up and all the local TV shows we had with Lorenzo the Clown and Vacuum Form and all the creepy crawlers and things like that. And
yes.
you couldn't have it today because you had a flat piece of plastic and you heated it up, you know. And if you had a chemistry set, the first thing that everybody did was mix all the chemicals together.
And blow up?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, my parents were very tolerant because it's amazing I didn't set the house on fire because I had so many electric connections and extension cords and plugging in here and plugging in there to get the red lights and the yellow lights and the green lights, the audio tape, you know, and the wires to the speakers. I was constantly replugging during the whole show, you know, different plugs and lights and stuff. The wires were like spaghetti back there. Of course, nothing shorted, nothing bad ever happened, but I can't imagine parents allowing that today.
No, I don't think so. Well, for one thing, it'll be too costly, I think.
Yes. From the University of Maryland, I then went to NYU School of the Arts. And while I was there, Sergeant Shriver, who was heading the Peace Corps at the time,
mm-hmm.
came and spoke to NYU, to the students, about the Peace Corps. And he mentioned a very special Peace Corps project in Colombia being done in educational and cultural television. And I became quite fascinated, and I applied for it to go to Colombia and produce television shows for kids for 2 years. And part of the motivation, of course, was it was Vietnam War time, and the Peace Corps, especially in our Democratic Draft Board in Baltimore, was a deferment.
Mm-hmm.
Not only a deferment, they didn't call you after that.
Oh, wow.
And along with that, I mean, that was an incentive, but along with that, I was so intrigued by the adventure and the idea of being able to live, you know, in a foreign country, another continent, learn another language, work in the other language, and also to be able to produce and direct television shows that would be televised all over Colombia right out of college. It was it was thrilling. And because I had had some theatrical experience, not just what I had done in my basement theater in college, you know, and the different projects and the theater stuff that I did in college, I got selected. And so I spent 2 years in Colombia producing a music show that was sort of like a forerunner of Sesame Street. It was called La Casa de Musica, and I had this charming Colombian woman who was sort of like a grown-up Shirley Temple aura about her, who played the hostess, and she was a trained musicologist. She trained in the United States. She trained also in Europe. She trained under Carl Orff at a certain point, too.
Really?
She was from one of the oligarchical families, the Samperes, and a wonderful, you know, wonderful woman, and very, very charming. So she was the hostess, and then we had two life-size puppets that would appear at the window. One was a cow named Rosa, one was a burro named Pascual, and Pascual got everything wrong, but Rosa got everything right. And these puppets would get more fan mail, you know. They were getting hundreds of letters every week from all around the country. In order to promote the show, because the Peace Corps had Stanford University come down to act like our Nielsen rating and go out into the field and see what effect, who was watching these programs and what effect they were having. Phillips Company had installed televisions in all of the church rec centers and in the schools across the country so that they could watch these programs. It was a big operation. And in order to promote La Casa de Musica, I, once a month, would take the entire show out on the road. And we would perform a live version, you know, for the students mm-hmm. That were coming from different villages and different towns. We would use an outdoor amphitheater or a large movie theater. And it's amazing because Hollywood didn't invent the star system. That's built into us. Because the first time we ever did this, we were in this huge sort of outdoor movie theater. And the kids had come from all around. The price of admission was that they had to bring an instrument that we had shown them how to make on television. Mm-hmm. And I went out on stage, and in Spanish, I said to the audience, all the kids, I said, "Who are we going to see today?" And they all yelled, "La Señorita Amalia," the hostess. And I said, "That's right." And then off stage, Amalia started playing the theme song of the show on her tiple, which is a Colombian instrument that looks like a guitar, but it's strung like a ukulele.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, she walked out on stage, and there was this dead silence for a second. And then, boom, the kids started screaming and rushing toward the stage. It was like they did not expect a live, full-color human being. They kind of thought either it was going to be a large television screen or some kind of electronic image. But there was this real person in color. Fortunately, we had lots of security, and so they held the kids off. And from then on, we made sure we had plenty of security whenever we did one of these live performances. After one of those performances, I was packing, making sure that everything was in the station wagons, all the props and everything. And this little boy was hanging around, looking in the station wagon. He was about 5 or 6. And I said to him, "What are you looking for?" And he said, "I'm looking for Pascual." Pascual was the burro puppet. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Pascual got the train back to Bogota already. He's already on his way back to Bogota." And the little kid started to cry, and he was holding something, and he held it up. He said, "I stayed up late last night making him this hat, but I couldn't get close enough to him today to give it to him."
Mm-hmm.
And the hat was something we had shown them how to make on television, but he had added his own touches, two holes for Pasquale's ears.
Oh,
and
really?
He had written on it, "I love you, Pasquale." He put his town, his school, his town, and his department, which is equivalent to like a state. When we started these Peace Corps television programs, none of these kids had any awareness that they lived in a town, let alone a state. You know, they were in a town among many towns in the country.
Right.
And so this was, you know, to see him list his town and his school and his state was quite impressive. I said, if you give me the hat, I'm going to see Pasquale as soon as I get back. And if you keep watching the show, he's going to show up and wear your hat. Sure enough, you know, we wrote it in. And a few days later, Pasquale arrives at the window wearing this hat. And Amalia said, "Where did you get that wonderful hat?" He says, "From my very good friend." And he gives the kid's name and the school and the town and the department. He said he made it especially for me. About 2 months later, I was at a reception at the U.S. Embassy for some newly arrived Peace Corps people that were going to be going out into the field. And there were some Peace Corps people working in that area, in that town, at the event. And they came over to me and they said, "You have no idea what you did." They were carrying that boy around on their shoulders, parading through town because he was mentioned on national television.
Ah, that's great.
So I always wondered what happened to him. Did he grow up to become a cartel chief?
Impressed a lot upon you, you know, as a young person, just to see all that wonder, you know, you just kind of take things for granted if you're an American, but you see something that it seems to be so simple, but it's just so magnificent for other people.
One of the great experiences of having this opportunity to spend 2 years, you know, in South America and in Colombia, and because I was able to speak Spanish, you know, I could really go out into the countryside and meet these people who had never been more than maybe 5-10 miles from where they were born, even, you mm-hmm. know, and talk to them and have conversations. And what I realized, you know, I always hear from people, "Oh, what would I say to that person? I have nothing in common with them. You know, what could we talk about?" And so forth and so on. But you know what? If you're human, you have something in common.
Exactly.
And I could sit with these people and we could chat. We found humor, you know, we found feelings that we could share, and whether they had any education or not, you know, we were able to communicate something, and I could relate.
Sure.
And so that taught me a lesson, you know, that we always have something in common with other people if we want to look for it. Well, after the Peace Corps, I came back to New York, and actually through one of the Peace Corps executives in Washington, I met the head of employment at CBS, and I ended up getting a job as a production assistant on Secret Storm, which was a big soap opera that had been running forever at that point, and Love of Life, another one. And so I started working in New York. I worked on both those soap operas as a production assistant, and that gave me an opportunity to start to get to know who was going to be doing what on Broadway, and what shows were going to be done, and so forth and so on. And I noticed that George Abbott, a veteran producer-director, who was then 81 years old and was going to be directing his 100th show as either a producer, writer, or director. I thought, oh, my God, to work for George Abbott.
Oh, wow, geez.
That would be incredible. So I wrote a letter, and I didn't get an answer. So I wrote another letter, and this time I took my resume and I cut it in half with a pinking shears, you know, mm-hmm. where you get the zigzag line.
Sure.
And then I attached the note. I said, "If you want to see the other half of me, I'm available at your convenience."
Oh, very clever.
And it got to him, and he called me in, and I went to work for George Abbott. And I worked with him on 3 different Broadway musicals. One was The Education of Hyman Kaplan.
Mm-hmm.
Another was a musical called The Fig Leaves Are Falling, which starred Dorothy Loudon and David Cassidy, who was not David Cassidy yet. And then we were called in. He was called in to be a doctor on a musical that was having trouble that David Merrick was producing called How Now, Dal Jones. Right. None of the 3 shows turned out to be hits.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I learned more by the fact that they didn't turn out to be hits than if they had been, because I really learned, you know, watching him handle the difficult situations or handle the situations, trying to improve what really couldn't be improved for, in the material, sure, was a great education for me. And working with Abbott was a great education. I remember we were standing, we were in Philadelphia with the education of Hyman Kaplan, and there was a scene where the audience was lost because it was supposed to be taking place in the teacher's room. It was a short scene, but the audience had no idea where they were or why the teachers were speaking the way they were.
Mm-hmm.
So it was apparent after the preview performance in Philadelphia, and the whole cast was now being called out on the stage for notes. And the set designers came over to Mr. Abbott, as we all called him, and said, Mr. Abbott, I've already called the scene shop in New York. They could get another whole set down here. They could fly it down, fly in where it would say teacher's room. You know, they're going on and on and on, and Abbott sort of stops them. And he turns to the stage, he points to one of the actresses that was right down front, and he said, you, yes, you, when the lights go up on that scene, I want you to say, here we are in the teacher's room. And he turned to the set designers and says, it's taken care of.
There you
one
go.
Line. Here we are in the teacher's room. So after working for George Abbott, I then went to work for the producers of MAME. And they were doing MAME was running on Broadway, and they were doing a production in Las Vegas, because at that time, you know, we've gone through these stages where we'll go through an era where they do Broadway musicals in Vegas, then that will disappear for a while. And in those days, they were doing a lot of Broadway musicals in Vegas, and they decided to do MAME there. And Susan Hayward was going to be playing MAME. So I went to work for them on the Broadway production that was still running, and also, you know, helping with this production that was going to be done in Las Vegas with Susan Hayward. That was a very interesting experience about celebrity, the concept of fame, because right after Susan Hayward started rehearsing, she was rehearsing at the Winter Garden Theater, and because that's where MAME was playing, and the Las Vegas production was rehearsing there. And I had to go over and get Susan Hayward to sign something, and I tried to time it for lunch. This is like right out of that. It felt right out of that movie from Valley of the Dolls, you know, where Susan Hayward is playing the very difficult diva, and the new employee at the law firm has to go over and have her sign some papers. So here I am trying to time it so that I would come over there just at the lunch break and get her to sign these papers. So I'm coming across town in a taxi trying to get there to the Winter Garden Theater in time. During the lunch hours, especially at Fifth Avenue, they practically walk over the hood of the taxis. I mean, the traffic of people.
Right.
And I'm thinking, as I'm watching all these people passing in front of the taxi, I'm thinking, my God, you know, it's really amazing. Every one of these people, you know, crossing in front of me, and like a blur, there's just so many of them. Every one of them knows the name Susan Hayward. Every one of them would recognize what she looks like. Most would even recognize her voice. I thought, what an amazing thing. Finally, I get to the theater, and I see that the lunch break has already started. The chorus kids, you know, are leaving to go out to lunch, carrying their rehearsal clothes in their Gucci bags, etc. And I walk in, and I said, did Miss Hayward leave yet? And they said, no, she's sitting on the stage. So I walk onto the stage. There's a work light. And then sitting there with no makeup, of a bushka, you would never recognize her, really, a bushka around her head, kind of a sweatshirt on, a shopping bag with her rehearsal stuff in it, not a Gucci bag, was Susan Hayward. And so I went, I said, I'm glad you're still here. I tried to time it for lunch. And I thought you would have left with them. And she says, no, she said, they never asked me to go to lunch. I said, oh. I said, well, would you like to go to lunch? She said, I would love to. She says, but the stage manager just went out to get me a sandwich. We'll do a rain check. I said, terrific. We never did that rain check. But here I was on the way over to see her, you know, in awe of the fact that everybody I was passing on the street, all the crowds everywhere, the lunchtime crowds, knew the name. They knew what she looked like. They would recognize her voice. And yet, in Susan Hayward's world, you know, there was the fact that she's in rehearsal for this show. The chorus kids all left the rehearsal. Nobody asked if she wanted to join them for lunch. She's got to sit there while the stage manager goes out and gets her a sandwich.
With her shopping bag.
And her shopping bag with her rehearsal clothes in it. The contrast was, you know, amazing. And it taught me, you know, that fame is really in the eyes of our of us, the beholder, not in the person who has it. You know, it was quite an experience that I never forgot.
Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, just thinking about how you were anticipating it, thinking, that person, I can pick anybody here, and they know Susan Hayward, and I'm going to go meet her.
That's right.
You know? and there she is.
Here she was, you know, just being left alone during rehearsal. Everybody went out to lunch. She's waiting for a sandwich. Delighted that I invited her to lunch. If she, you know, hadn't ordered the sandwich, she would have been thrilled to go. So, I mean, yes, it means that we're all human.
Yes, exactly.
But,
exactly.
You know, the famous people don't see themselves the way we do, the way we see them. They just are in their own world with the people that are in their world surrounding them, you know, and the things that they have to deal with.
Sure.
So it was a great lesson. And, of course, it helped me as a producer to have a better understanding when working with celebrities. Of course, I've worked with many and then worked with many people who ultimately became celebrities through having worked with me or through other efforts.
My short 4 years in New York, I really admired actors. They never got the spotlight, but they were consistently working actors, and they were able to put their kids through college and have a pretty good life, you know. Some of them, of course, you know, Actors Equity supposedly has 80 to 90% unemployment at any given time. It's very admirable, you know. This guy will never have the spotlight. You'll never know him on the street, but he's good at his craft, and he's been working hard, and he's made a living.
Well, you know, actors reach a certain level where they are working professional actors, and they will continue to have jobs and job offers.
Mm-hmm.
When you're young and you're thinking about acting, the majority of people thinking about acting think about being famous.
Right.
And for people who need fame, who emotionally and neurotically and for whatever other reasons feel that they just need the fame, and we can talk about that phenomenon a little bit later, that's why they want to be interested in acting. However, there are a great number of actors who are in it for the craft because they love acting. And as a matter of fact, they're relieved not to have the burdens, you know, of fame.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because I remember an actor once saying to me, one day I woke up and I realized I was now a professionally working actor and I was going to always have another job. It was sort of he had moved into that level and suddenly realized it, you know. I also had an actress, very well-known actress, say to me one time, an actor's job is to audition. An actor's vacations is when he's in a show or a movie.
Very good. I like that.
Yeah, another good comment. But the need for the fame, has, you know, many divas, including Josephine Baker, the subject of my new musical, were driven to fame to overcome, you know, feelings of inferiority, deep feelings of inferiority from when they were young. A good example is Barbara Streisand, you know, the ugly duckling, who just had to be the belle of the ball, who had to be Cinderella. I've even seen interviews where she mentioned that even she didn't believe that her own mother loved her.
Mm-hmm.
And so the drive, you know, to be famous, to be so big that you'd be accepted, that everybody would like you, becomes enormously strong. Cass Elliot, you know, who went to Forest Park High School, Ellen Cohen, who I knew, we went there together, we did summer stock together. You know, she was another one who was made fun of. She was this fat, you know, girl who had one high sock up, usually when you saw her, and one high sock down. She wore, you know, she had braces with spinach in it. The first time I met her, that was what she looked like to me. She wanted to get involved in the dramatics club at Forest Park. And she said to me, I'm going to be a movie star. And she said it with such intensity that I had two reactions. I mean, the first was, is she crazy? The second was, the way she's saying it, maybe she knows something that I don't. But she also, I always felt, had to be famous.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't become a movie star in that sense, but she discovered she had perfect pitch.
Oh, what a great voice.
And
what
then, and became voice. This fabulous singer and recording star. And I always said that her need to be that famous, just like I believe with the other divas, was not because they wanted to be better than anybody else or more superior to anyone else, but that if she could be as tall as the Empire State Building, she could be equal to everybody else.
Right.
Because they were coming from such depths of inferiority that it took that kind of size just to feel equal.
Yeah,
and the problem with that for most people, is if you get it, and Barbara Streisand got it, and Cass Elliot got it, and Josephine Baker got it, if you get it, you know, you're on a high, that's fantastic, until you wake up the next morning, still, you know, the fat little girl being picked on, or the ugly duckling in Brooklyn, you know, or in Josephine Baker's case, the little nappy-haired girl thrown face down in the mud by white hoodlums for being who she was, black.
Right.
Josephine overcame that. Josephine Baker was able to overcome that by her work in the French underground, risking her life, delivering the Italian code to the Allies, being decorated by de Gaulle. She came to have the self-worth, you know, that the thing that she drove to have the fame for. Not all of them were that fortunate. Cass Elliot turned to drugs. You know, I don't know if she ever reached the point where she didn't feel she was the fat little girl still being picked on.
I think we have a few shows here, don't you? Because we have a lot of material. But let's continue with how Grease evolved.
Well, I had already done two shows in New York, two hit shows, Fortune to Men's Eyes, which Sal Mineo had directed, and Miss Riordan Drinks a Little, by Pulitzer Prize winning author, playwright, Paul Zindel. I starred Julie Harris and Estelle Parsons. And I get a call from my college roommate at Maryland, Phil Markin, who from Baltimore. We had both gone to Forest Park. He was taking an orthodontry course in the summer of 1971, this was, in Chicago. And he called me and he said, my wife and I went to see this little play in the basement of a trolley barn, sort of a community theater. And it was all about the drapes and drapettes that hung out in the back of Forest Park High. And, of course, I had not thought about any of that. You know, the 60s was such a volatile and filled with changes and such a political period.
Oh, yeah.
That it made the 50s, it made 1959, 1958, seem like 100 years earlier. And so I had not thought about any of that. Suddenly, you know, he's bringing back these memories. I checked around to see if anybody knew anything about this amateur production out there that was running on the weekends that summer. And one person said they had heard something about it, that it was a community theater and amateur production, and that it wasn't very good. But Phil Markin, who was known at the University of Maryland as the ultimate pessimist, he never had a positive thing to say about anything. That was his MO. He called me back and he said, I really think you should come out and take a look at this. And I thought, you know what? That's the first optimistic thing I've ever heard Phil say. And I've known him, you know, since high school. So I flew out. He and his wife at that time, Jane, met me at the airport. And we went to the Kingston Mines Theater, which was in the basement of this old trolley barn. There were no seats. We were given newspapers when we walked in, and we sat on the floor. The cast, mostly amateurs, had painted the scenery themselves so you could see the drip marks. Mm-hmm. There was a like a three-piece band with no written music, so they sort of jamming, which meant if you could hear any lyrics, you were pretty lucky. There were about five or six songs in this play that didn't seem to have a plot or anything that went on and on and on, but they did sound exactly like songs that we would have listened to back in the 50s. The minute the show started, the minute the lights went up, and the cast came running out on stage, it was like my Forest Park yearbook come to life.
Oh, my.
You know, and I thought, wow, there's a magic here. Mm-hmm. I thought that Jim Jacobs and Warren Casey, who had written the book Music and Lyrics, had great talent, and that they really did have the ability to rewrite this as a full musical. And so I met with them afterwards, you know, and I told them that I really felt if they were willing to move to New York and I would work with them, that they could rewrite this as a full Broadway musical and that Broadway audiences would really respond. They agreed, mm-hmm. you know, and they moved to New York and we started working. They wrote a full score. We picked Danny and Sandy were two characters in the ensemble, but they weren't the central characters. We pulled them out and made them the central characters. Mm-hmm. And then I began thinking about who should direct and who should choreograph. And at first I thought of the choreography because Patricia Birch had just done a big off-Broadway hit called The Me Nobody Knows, in which she was working with non-actors, non-dancers. They were all actors, non-dancers, but she made them look like they were really dancers. She had gotten tremendous humor out of the work. Most importantly, for what I was looking for, she kept everything looking so real that you forgot that they were actors. And I wanted that for Grease. I did not want it to become one of these Dames at Sea or 42nd Street, rah-rah, you know, two-dimensional satires. It would be satirical no matter what we did, but I wanted you to really feel these kids came out of a cedar chest. They came out of an old yearbook. They were the real thing. And when the show was over, they didn't change out of their costumes. They hopped into the jalopy and they went out for hamburgers.
All right.
And I knew Pat would give us that in the choreography and musical staging. So I began thinking about who should direct with these same qualities. And I had remembered seeing at St. Clement's Church, it was running for 2 weekends. It was a one-act play about a quadriplegic and his nurse. And, of course, the quadriplegic never left the bed. But the nurse was moving around, and there was so much movement on that stage, even though one character could move. It was called Welcome to Andromeda. And he'd gotten so much humor, too, out of this very serious, depressing subject. But the thing that, you know, that struck me the most was I had to keep pinching myself to remind myself that these were actors. They seemed so real, and that even I was fooled. And I kept having to remember, nope. She's not a real nurse. He's not a real quadriplegic. They're actors. And I thought, wow, that's what we want from Grease. Tom Moore, who directed that, was the associate director of the Mark Taper Forum in Los Angeles at the time. So I contacted him. I had him fly in to New York. Actually, I had met him earlier because I had seen this piece 3 years earlier is when I saw Welcome to Andromeda. And I was going out to L.A., and I just had to meet the director of this piece. And so Tom and I had met, and we had a wonderful lunch, and I knew that someday I would be working with him. Well, after that, I did Fortune in Men's Eyes, which Sal Mineo directed, and then I did Miss Reardon Drinks a Little, which Mel Bernhardt directed. But now I'm going to be doing Grease, and I remembered Tom, and I remembered seeing that play, and I remembered how real those people were. So I flew Tom into New York to meet the writers and to meet Pat Birch. And he and Pat Birch hit it off beautifully. Tom said to me, though, I never liked these greaser kids when I was in high school. I couldn't stand them. I don't know if I'm right for this. And when I took him back to the airport, I said, read the script again on the plane. I said, you are going to make them likable. I said, you as the director will make them likable. I said, Jim and Warren are the encyclopedias on the period and on greaser behavior. So they'll take care of that part. So when he got back to L.A., he ran right to a phone booth, no cell phones in those days, and he called me and he said, I hope I hadn't talked you out of hiring me.
Oh, that's great.
And I said, no, not at all. So we started to work on it. He then went to work with the writers on finishing up what would be the rehearsal draft, further developing it, further developing the characters, further developing Sandy and Danny, creating some additional songs over and above the expanded score that they had already done. And then we started casting. We auditioned about 1,000 actors because we were looking for actors who not only would look right, but, you know, who could sing well, who could, certainly they had to be good actors, and who could dance, at least dance well enough for Pat Birch to make them look like they were terrific dancers. Mm-hmm. And so that was not an easy task. It is no wonder that of the original 16 actors that we picked for the original cast, and then those that we picked for the national tour and the replacements and the other tours, it's no wonder that so many of them went on to become majorly famous.
Oh, yeah.
We sort of gave birth to a whole new generation of stars, Treat Williams, Richard Gere, Patrick Swayze, John Travolta, of course, who started in the stage production, Mary Lou Henner, many people, plus Walter Bobby, who became a very successful Broadway director, Chicago, and other shows. So our tough casting policies, Alan Paul, who became the Manhattan Transfer, still, you know, hot today as ever. So our tough casting needs and our willingness to not settle and to look for the people we thought we needed really paid off, not only for Grease, but it paid off in creating a whole generation of terrific, famous actors.
Talk a little bit now. We're getting a little bit close to the end. And talk about Josephine. But I would like to throw this out at you. I'd love to do a show just basically about Grease and then another show about Josephine.
Absolutely.
If you would be, you know, willing to come back.
Sure. That would be terrific.
Okay. So right now, just give us a little teaser about Josephine.
I had seen Josephine Baker perform live at the Palace Theater in 1973. And I was totally taken. By then, she was about 67 years old. But she still had all the glamour and all the glitz, you know, of the famous legendary Josephine Baker, who started out, who became famous, dancing practically nude with a string of bananas. But then she went on to become an Erte model. She had a long affair with Crown Prince Gustav of Sweden. And she ended up being in the French underground and delivering the Italian code to the Allies and being decorated by de Gaulle. When she died in 1975, she was given a 21-gun salute in Paris, the first foreign woman to ever be given such an honor.
Mm-hmm.
So she was a remarkable woman, a black woman way, way ahead of her time. She achieved enormous things and became an icon. And still today, she studied in an elementary school. You go into the children's section of libraries, you'll see books on her. She's remained an icon. I was very impressed with her as a phenomenon when I saw her in person. And a few years after that, she died in 1975. And not too many years after that, Suzanne DePass, who was second in command at Motown, called me and said, the first biography written by her manager of 25 years has come on the market. We've optioned it because Diana Ross wants to play Josephine Baker on Broadway. Would you read it and see if there's a handle to justify a musical? So I said, sure, send it to me. So she sent it to me, and it was sort of a then-and-then type biography, but supposedly in Josephine Baker's own words, mixed in, was this affair she had with Crown Prince Gustav of Sweden.
Oh.
And I thought to myself, Prince and the Showgirl, always a winner. Worked for Marilyn Monroe and Laurence Olivier. And so I called her back, and I didn't tell her that. I said, I do see a handle, though. But I don't believe that Diana Ross is going to commit to 2 years on Broadway, 8 performances a week. I said, if there's some way before we get in bed together to find, get more definite about this. She said, well, let me see. I know she's dying to do it. She says it has to be on stage first. She idolizes Josephine Baker. I'll get back to you.
Mm-hmm.
3 months later, she calls me back and she says, you're right. She'll never do it. So after that, I stopped thinking about it. I don't know what happened to the book or whatever. And now go back about 9 years or so. I'm cleaning out a box, maybe 10. I'm cleaning out a box in my LA apartment. And at the bottom of the box is this book. And so I start reading the book. And now I've lived, 20 some years longer,
mm-hmm.
A lot more life experience. And suddenly in reading this, sitting on the floor by the box, I see what must have been, or what I'm convinced was, the entire psychological makeup of Josephine Baker, what drove her, coming from the slums of East St. Louis, where these white hoodlums in 1917, she was about 11 years old, came through. They killed a lot of the blacks. They burnt down a lot of the converted boxcars where they were living by the railroad track. She was thrown face down in the mud, she claims, basically because of who she was. She managed to escape with her mother. I realized that was when she made that decision that she would have to be so big, money, fame, the arms of royalty, that could never happen to her again. And I suddenly started seeing the story. And I spent the next several months sort of writing down a story
mm-hmm.
and that I would want told. And then I started to continue. I was working on some other things, but I continued to think about it. And then made the decision, I'm going to do this, And so I started thinking about who could write the book, who could write the music, who could write the score. And it took a few years to sort of assemble the right group. And then we started developing it. And we're now ready to go. We did a extremely successful series of what they call pre-Broadway stage and choreographed performances
mm-hmm.
here in New York. With Deborah Cox playing Josephine Baker. Deborah's a Grammy-nominated, award-winning recording artist. She also played the lead in the Disney production of Aida on Broadway. And she just completed a tour of a revival of Jekyll and Hyde, for which she got rave reviews all across the country and standing ovations everywhere. She was signed to do that tour, so she was so wonderful in our pre-Broadway run-throughs, and all of Broadway was embracing her. so strongly that we decided we would just have to wait for her to finish the tour, which contractually she finished up at the end of this summer. And we're now ready to proceed on opening the show, which we plan to hopefully do next year. We're waiting for a theater. There's a big crunch on Broadway. Since shows run longer than ever now, the hits, and there are so many hits, the available theaters are less than ever. But it looks like we'll have one for next year, and we're very excited about it.
That's terrific. It sounds.
The music is by Steve Dorff, and the lyrics are by John Bettis. And I found them. They came from the pop world. They wrote "One Moment in Time" for Whitney Houston and Barbra Streisand's "Higher Ground," and they've written an incredible score for this show. It's a very sexy show, Folie Bergère, the chorus girls with legs up to their neck, you know, and the fabulous Josephine Baker, played by Deborah Cox.
That sounds terrific. And like I said, I would really like to do a couple more shows. We could do it on Greece and centralize on Josephine and that evolution if you'd like to come back.
Oh, I would love to.
That's terrific.
You know, it's a way, I come back to Baltimore quite frequently, but this is a way to come back without having to get on the train.
That's right, exactly. Well, thank you very much, Ken. I appreciate you coming on to Baltimore Internet Radio and sharing your stories and sharing your career.
Thank you. This has been a pleasure.
This is Dave Custy. You've been listening to Baltimore Internet Radio.